It is impossible to describe the feeling that took possession of me as months rolled by and I saw the active employment of a prosperous people move smoothly and quietly along in the absence of masculine intelligence and wisdom, cut off from all inquiry by my ignorance of their language. The singular absence of the male sex began to prey upon my imagination as a mystery. The more so after visiting a town at some distance composed exclusively of schools and colleges for the youth of the country. Here I saw hundreds of children, and all of them were girls. Is it to be wondered at that? The first inquiry I made was, where are the men? I had put the question to Juana one day, but she professed never to have heard of such beings. It silenced me for a time. Perhaps it is some extinct animal, she added naively. We have so many new things to study and investigate that we pay but little attention to ancient history. I bided my time and put the query in another form. Where is your other parent? She regarded me with innocent surprise. You talk strangely. I have but one parent. How could I have any more? I saw that there was some mystery I could not unravel at present, and fearing to involve myself in some trouble, refrained from further questioning on the subject.
This opening is taken from Mizora, a prophecy, first serialized in 1880 and published as a book in 1889. It frames our debate about literary representations of single-sex societies, a topic that could hardly be timed better, I think. I'm Stephanie Schaefer, and this is Lady Fiction, a podcast dedicated to reading women in North America. In the last weeks, the U.S. has been shaken by an unprecedented leakage from the Supreme Court. Justice Alito has written the court's majority opinion in the pending case of Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which addresses the constitutionality of a Mississippi state law that bans abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The final vote is expected in June or July 2022, a few weeks from now. But if the leaked opinion carries, this would effectively overturn the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, which ruled that the Constitution protects a pregnant woman's liberty to choose to have an abortion. Overturning Roe v. Wade would not, of course, reduce abortions, but rather expose pregnant women to health risks if they choose to terminate a pregnancy, forcing them to give birth. Commentators have started talking about a post-Roe v. Wade era, where access to contraception as well as LGBTQ+ rights might come under similar attacks by a conservative Supreme Court, all issues representing the will of an evangelical and conservative, mostly white, U.S. populace. So, as we're watching a few conservative individuals writing laws that affect women's rights to making decisions over their own bodies, I think it is high time to address a literary take on this, an imagined world without men. Here with me today is Professor Judith Rauscher from the University of Köln, who is kind of an expert on this. First of all, she's the author of Eco-Poetic Placemaking, Nature and Mobility in Contemporary American Poetry, a monograph that is currently under review. But she's also the co-editor of Gender Forum, where she's preparing a special issue on gender violence and the state in contemporary speculative fiction. Her research interests include gender and queer studies, as well as feminist criticism and speculative fiction of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And in this capacity, I'm super happy to have her as an expert on speculative fiction and gender. Welcome, Judith.
Hi, Stephanie. I'm really, really happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you. When we started talking about this podcast episode, we didn't know what would happen in May 2022. So it's on the one hand grueling, and on the other hand, I think a great example for how literature can become a laboratory for thinking about how the world might be differently. And the text that we kind of agreed on anchoring this discussion in is Charlotte Perkins Gilman's Herland, a novel from 1915, which imagines a world without men that is discovered by three male travelers. So we'll talk about this text. There are a host of other texts that we also read for this episode. So I'm really excited about a firework of ideas and states imagined without binary gender system and power structures. But maybe let's start talking Herland a little bit and take it from there. Why did you choose this? And yes, what's going on?
Right. So why did I choose this? I've been interested in single-sex societies for quite a while. And the first one I ever came across in classes was Gilman's Herland, because it's arguably the most famous of its kind. And then as I was taking other courses on women's literature, I came across a few other ones, The Female Man, for example, a text from the 80s. And then I was starting to wonder whether there were other ones. And I started digging, and there are many. Yeah, there are a lot. And so I chose Gilman because she is the most famous, and a lot of people know her work. And she also arguably represents one of the main strands or of this type of narratives, which is the feminist utopia.
Yes, exactly. And in the opening quote, which was not from Herland but from another text that we're going to discuss, you kind of pinned this also down. What do we do with this absence of men? Why are there no men? And don't those women that live in those societies have two parents? And then the answer is, it's strikingly, well, I have one parent, all's good, I don't need a second one. So the key question that's always in debate in these texts is, how do they reproduce? What are the futurities of these utopian communities when they don't have men? How do they procreate? Let's get this out of the way and answer it for Herland and also maybe for the other texts. And then we can talk about all the other things that come with having single-sex societies.
Right. I didn't want to be super mysterious about this, although, as you've said from this quote from Mizora, in these texts, it's also often constructed as a mystery. So the people who come in from the outside are wondering, and in this quote that I've read, it's Vera, it's the narrator who comes in from the outside, and she's wondering, where are all the men? So yeah, so it's constructed as a mystery. But let's get this out of the way. Both in Mizora and also in Herland, women reproduce without men. In Mizora, they reproduce scientifically with sort of some chemical process that isn't explained further. In Herland, they reproduce via parthenogenesis, so out of themselves. They essentially, they reproduce from within themselves.
Yeah. And so biologically, there's no need for a male counterpart. And while that's really one of the intriguing questions about the text, there's so much more that goes beyond this that is negotiated. What I find interesting is, and maybe we can start from there also, why are there so many texts around the turn of the 19th to the 20th century that come out, a time that's also the time of the fight for suffrage, which finally comes in 1920? Which is written into law. It's the time of the woman question, so to speak. So that will be one of my tentative answers to this. But why do people like to imagine a feminist utopia at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have given part of the answer. I think it has to do with the first wave of feminism that is going on at the time, but also with the frustrations that come with that, because women don't gain the vote until, 1920. And so they've been fighting that fight for the vote, but also for other rights for quite a while. And another reason, I guess, is the general upsurge of utopian literature at the time. And scholars often relate that to other sort of struggles compounding at the time. There is labor struggles, there's racial tension following Reconstruction. But there's also progress, social progress, industrialization. The society is changing, and in a rapid way, where people begin to imagine, if society is changing so quickly now, what is America going to be like in 10 years? What is it going to be like in 100 years, right? And people have written these kind of utopian speculative texts before, or wrote them before. But yeah, there's this upsurge, generally speaking, of utopian literature at the time, as well as feminist writing. And then when these two come together, I think the feminist utopia is the logical choice. And then there's another period where that happens, and that's during second wave feminism. So during the 70s and 80s, when we get, again, a big number of these feminist utopias or single-sex societies.
So the utopian genre here is one that articulates social criticism of the status quo in the present. So that one present would be the 1880s. The second one would be, which I find so intriguing, would be the 1960s and 70s, and says things as they are not okay, to say the least. And a better world would be possible if, or a better world might be possible if we could do away with a few reality effects here and turn into a different place. So the utopian, on the one hand, is the beautiful, and on the other hand, it's also, in these texts, the no place. In Herland, we have three male travelers who are discoverers, so like pioneers, kind of. So Herland is a place that is located behind the mountains. And maybe we can quickly talk about what kind of place, how they get there, what they come across, and then, as this is the latest, the 1915 publication of the text that we're looking at, look at the other places and how the travelers discover them or how they get there.
Right, absolutely, of course. Yeah, so in Gilman's text, these three travelers, as you said, they're explorers, and they go to South America, and they've heard rumors about this strange land of women in the mountains, in a valley cut off civilization. And so they go and explore, and they use, you know, technology, like they fly there, which is how they come across this valley or this land, which has been separated from the rest of the world for centuries, if not longer. And they land, and they find that it's a land of women. So I guess what is sort of inscribed in that, of course, is, again, is this imagination of exploration, of discovery. As you have suggested, there's this idea of the lost race, which is also prominent at the end of the 19th century and in the early 20th century in speculative, early speculative fiction, right? This idea that you discover a land and a people that has not been in contact with the world, and that works differently from your own society. So yeah, again, as with the long tradition of utopian literature, there's always this comparison. And the men who enter the Herland in that case, they also, of course, compare. They compare the land that they see, which is beautiful, and everything looks well designed. Everything is clean. The women are beautiful. They're sort of Amazonian in stature, and they are. That's also mentioned explicitly in Gilman's text. They're of Aryan stock, which is,
yes,
of course.
It's also outspoken racial tendency there to preserve whiteness also. Yeah.
Right. So this is in South America, but of course the women that they find are European women.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And maybe it's important to note that the three discoverers, that you can put them in the character scale more or less. So the first person narrator is the one who kind of does best with dealing with this society. He marries one of the women and kind of gets the best of both worlds. So the question is, what do the discoverers do with this discovery? Do they integrate? Do they break away from it? Do they leave? And then the other two Jeff is a tender soul. He's too romantic. And what's the other guy's name?
Oh, I always keep blanking. Terry?
Terry?
Yes.
Terry.
He's a rogue. And
Terry is a rogue. He's a ladies' man, but not in a good way.
No.
So he really is out to conquer, and he fails miserably.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. So when the three explorers arrive, they're captured by the women of Herland, but then they eventually meet women. Each of them gets one woman, and they're sort of types, as you've just said, right? The narrator, he's the ethnographer. He has a scientific mind. He describes the society. He produces the record that we readers then get presented with. And yes, he marries, and eventually also takes his wife to the outside world to show her what life is like outside of Herland. And Jeff, he stays behind. He and his wife, they make a baby, so this is why he stays behind. And then there's Jeff, who he's the rogue, he's the ladies' man, not in a good way. He tries to rape the woman that he starts a relationship with, because she refuses to engage with him sexually. He tries to rape her, and this is also why the men then are being expelled, or why Terry is expelled, and Van then follows along as well.
And it's important that all three of them have to start relationships. So as you said, I mean, Van Dyck, the narrator, is an ethnographer, so he has a more or less scholarly perspective on things. But the romance plot has to happen. That's how the narrative works from Van Dyck's perspective, because
right.
The women are so beautiful, of course they're there to be conquered, and every man does his conquering in his own kind of way.
Absolutely.
But when I first read this was so disappointing.
Yes,
I was really put up off by that, I read this in my studies, and I was like, oh, come on, can we have a society, a utopia, where the discoverers are not conquerors, and we end up in heteronormative relationships and marriage is operated. So I want to talk to you about Perkins Gilman's feminist politics here. She herself was an orator. She was independent. She lived off her own money and her pen. I don't know, to be devil's advocate, why do we need marriages? What do we need them for, Judith?
Right, and I mean, I guess in a way that, it's a very good question, because the women do very well, right? They have developed this mythical ability to reproduce. They're doing fine. Also sort of within the logic Gilman places them under, where not only are they doing fine, they're doing very well, because they've established the system where only the best of them reproduce. And so they've perfected their society. This is actually why they're so beautiful, and why they're so athletic, and all these sort of, and so smart and everything. So they're doing very well. But then, as it turns out, once they see men, at least some of them, the ones that we were sort of told more about, they realize that they've been missing something, right?
Oh.
And it's interesting, they've been missing something, but then again, and this goes to what you're saying, right? Do we need those heteronormative relationships? I mean, there's these heterosexual relationships that are being introduced, but they're not necessarily or strictly heteronormative in the context of the time.
Mm.
Because the woman that is paired with Terry the rogue, she also is passionate like him. This is why the two come together in the first place, right? She's strong-willed and she's passionate. But that's also why she refuses him, and why he has to try to use violence to get her into bed, which he fails at also, because she's protected by one of her sisters. And the partner of Van, the narrator, she's smart, and she, she's of the scientific mind like he is, right? And she also refuses to to sleep with him, at least initially, because, you know, she wants to travel the world with him eventually, right? And doesn't want to give up her career and so forth. So it's not strictly heteronormative in this way. The one sort of very traditionally heteronormative relationship that we then get is between Jeff and his beloved, who is as romantic and traditional as he is. Yeah, so Gilman gives us these different options, but the frame still remains strictly heterosexual.
I mean, of course, with these three pairs, we also have a scope,
right,
a variation of how relationships can go. And at the end of it, I guess I'm happy here with your answer. So it is feminist.
No,
in that it projects women's desires, and generally, I think a critique of domesticity, because Jeff, he's so soft. Mm-hmm. He really is also, you know, the kind of the laughing stock. So masculinity is formed and shaped by the feminine ideals, and he kind of manages to integrate and stay there because he's malleable. And the other two kind of preserve their own personality and make compromises. And of course, I mean, there's poetic justice in the fact that, you know, the narrator has the most successful relationship, so to speak.
Right. No, but I do share your frustration, right? No,
yeah.
I get it. Because, you know, it's not as queer as one would maybe hope or imagine. That comes much, much later, where that option is something that these authors bring up. And I mean, it is still it is frustrating because there was queerer literatures out there, right, at the time.
Yeah.
Sexology was talking about non-straight, non-heterosexual desire, and but that doesn't really come into this text. And in that way, to maybe also go back to that initial sort of question, to go back to Perkins's feminism, it is in certain ways conservative, but then also for its time it was still radical in other ways.
It's that the typical white feminist, politically organized feminist approach to say we demand equality, we don't want to overthrow the system, we don't want to, you know, do everything, do away with the world as we know it. So
or only overthrow the system in certain ways, right? Because Gilman was imagining that if women were freed from childcare within this sort of nuclear family, because, you know, in her land, children are taken care of in like kindergarten type, school types places. They're not necessarily with their mothers. Mothers can pursue their careers if they so wish. And also not everybody's a mother, so other women step in, right? So she imagines women freed from these kind of restraints, and is radical in that way. So she does imagine a radically different world for women in that respect, but not in other ways that we could maybe think of nowadays.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, we have to mention the other texts that she wrote that is so iconic, and that negotiates motherhood, namely The Yellow Wallpaper, a text that is about a postpartum depression, where a young mother is kept from doing anything other than lying around and staring at the wall. She's not allowed to have any food other than broth. She's not allowed a pen or paper, no drawing, no nothing. She's just supposed to rest. And over this resting, she starts going crazy. So Gilman is the figure who negotiates motherhood that has been long canonized at the turn of the century. And motherhood in her land also is kind of out. It's taken out of the picture. It's not a burden anymore.
No, it's not a burden. It's become something like a religion, right?
Yeah.
So in a way it's supplemented, but, you know, so everybody reveres mothers, everybody reveres and respects children. And of course, all of that is also part of this logic of perfection, because it's children who always represent more perfection. Mm-hmm. If the women do their job and they self-select, right, and only the best of them reproduce, then, and of course, with all the problematic associations that
it's
comes
your,
with.
It's eugenics, right?
Exactly. And I mean, Gilman was also famous precisely for advocating eugenics and euthanasia and so forth to perfect society.
Yeah, the white race, so to speak.
Absolutely.
So, mm-hmm. So, Gilman's is the text that comes latest in the kind of selection that we prepare for this session.
Yes.
And I, looking back at the other texts, I also find it the least revolutionary in this way. And I really want to talk about Mizora, which I, you know, thumbed through digitally and which works differently. So here the discoverer is a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a kind of a long frame narrative to this where she also, the question is, how does she get on the road? Why does she travel? I mean, she's happily married. She's a Russian-American.
She's a Russian. Yes. She's a revolutionary. She has to leave the country during the revolution, during the backlash. And then she sort of she escapes, I think, via Siberia, which is why she ends up at the, you know, North Pole. And she spent some time with Inuit there. That's sort of part of that long frame narrative that you were talking about. But a very interesting one, right? So it's not like she doesn't go straight to Mizora. But eventually she takes up this challenge that one of the Inuit poses to her, saying, you know, like she wants to go to the U.S.
She wants to row home towards France across the North Sea.
Right.
Fantastic.
So, and there's this challenge that one of the Inuit poses to her where it's like, no man has ever, you know, managed to go across. Right. And she's like, well, I can do it. And so she does. And she gets sucked into this maelstrom and sort of gets sucked under the ice. So this is, I imagine, right, into this. Almost magical luminescent world under the pole, right? It's this sort of hollow earth idea, right? Where she's like she's sucked into this world where, of course, it's not cold or, you know, hostile.
But it's like Italy. It's Eden. Even balmier than Italy.
Italy?
I was quite taken with the description.
Absolutely. It's paradise.
Raw meat with the Inuit, and she learns to survive there, and she also likes the fact that she, you know, is adapted to cold climes, so it doesn't bother her, but it's really kind of, you know, discomforting to say the least. And then all of a sudden she ends up in this beautiful female-only world where all the women are blonde. That's one of the most important points from the beginning.
Yes.
So all the people who are there are blonde, but then they're not as pretty as the Herlanders.
Right. I mean, I guess they're also not as pretty. No, they're described. So there's ways in which that text is like Lane's text is similar in that, yes, they're also blonde. And in that way, they're different from the narrator who has dark hair. And that's also made much of, right? And that's also the reason why eventually she becomes a bit critical of that idea that, you know, of that their idea of perfection and perfect beauty. But she describes them as having like big torsos and like they're super strong. They're tall and they're strong. And it has to do, interestingly, because you just mentioned the raw meat that Vera, the narrator, has been eating with the Inuit. All the food that she gets in Mizora is vegetarian, right? Or I mean, it's artificially grown meat, right? It's chemically grown food.
Yeah.
There are no more animals because that is considered inefficient use of land and inefficient use of inefficient production of food because animals aren't as clean as the kind of food that can be produced chemically. So the women that she encounters there are very advanced scientifically and technologically, which is also why I find this text much more interesting than Herland. I mean, there's some mention of like vehicles, motorized vehicles in Herland as well, but I mean, that's like 35 years later. And Mary Bradley Lane also imagines these kind of vehicles and like communication technology like Zoom and weird stuff. They have everything.
Yeah.
It's pretty
amazing. And I mean, this is throughout the text, I think science is spelled with a capital S. And even in the frame narrative, Vera, the narrator, talks about how she's fascinated with science. So there's really a turn towards science as a as a recipe to make the world better. And these wonderful women chemists who have, you know, so many ways in survival, they really are also an ecologically better community, because they don't have to go through all the eating the animals and polluting the world from that perspective. That's what I just thought when you were speaking. It's also an ecologically cleaner world that they leave. Right. Their footprints are...
Absolutely. Cleanliness is super important in everything, in food, in the surrounding. And that's sort of part of the argument, or part of the... This is how the world works, and Vera finds out about this. This is how they've become who they are. This is how they become have become so perfect, right? This is the idea. They are surrounded by beautiful nature, and they're in clean air and clean water, and they're eating clean food that they have sort of artificially, you know, produced. And it's so clean that they have become the best that they can be over generations. Yeah. And they've, again, perfected themselves. And of course, and then that's where sort of the dark side of it all comes in again, because Lane is as racist, if not more so than Gilman, where part of that development towards perfection is, and they sort of explicitly say, so they have bred out, or, you know, undesirable traits, including, you know, dark hair. Certainly there's nobody who's not white. And while men have also been lost in the process of perfection, right? They've, in a way, actively eliminated men because they were sort of polluting society. And then, luckily, they were so proficient in science that they also found a way to keep society going, right? Mm. But, there's this dark side.
Can you quickly talk... how did they lose the men?
I mean, lose is actually not right. So there's this, there's this moment in the text, which I also find very interesting, where they go through the history. History is not talked about much in Mizora. It's sort of forgotten because it's, you know, so ancient history is not something that concerns the women anymore. But Vera, of course, is interested, right? So she always keeps asking, where are the men? And so eventually she gets an answer. And the story is sort of, there were wars and a lot of men died. I mean, there's sort of these, you know, essentially there was a civil war, right? And everybody started killing each other. A lot of the men died. And eventually women were so... fed up, but also afraid for their lives and the lives for the children, that they take over the government and they create a women's republic that for about 100 years, that's the initial plan, I think, keep men, what they want to keep men out of government, and they introduce all these kinds of reform laws that also women suffragists or feminists at the end of the 19th century were sort of fighting for, right? They introduce all of these reforms, but one of these reforms that they also introduce is that everybody who is violent, or again, who commits a crime or exhibits any sort of undesirable traits, is taken sort of out of the, is taken out of the reproductive system, in that sense that they don't get to reproduce. So there's eugenics, and it's this very short phrase where it's like, so they put in these laws where everybody's imprisoned or can't reproduce who commits crimes or is, you know, in some ways not a perfect citizen. And then they say, like, after a few decades, the man question had sort of solved itself, right? So men take themselves out of the... they're essentially eliminated. And then once women realize that they can sort of reproduce chemically, they just give up on producing men children. It's like, what is this weird vocabulary I'm using? But like, so they just have only girls. And so this is how Mizora comes about.
Yeah. And it's interesting how this narratively is presented, right? It's matter of fact, you know, that's how it was. That's how it worked. And of course, at the turn of the 19th or the 20th century, we also have all these anxieties around the replaceability of men if women should get the vote, if women should have more rights. I'm thinking also of Charles Dana's Gibson girl, a figure in visual culture who comes up as parallel to the new woman in the 1880s and 90s with the big hair and the very, very athletic. She rides bikes, which is scandalous. And there's lots of cartoons that show those healthy, sprightly Gibson girls examining small men under a magnifying glass. So you have these minuscule men who can't keep up with these fabulous new women. And there's a huge argument about women going astray, you know, the family order being destroyed if they should have more rights or, you know, have the right to keep their own money if they're in a marriage, if they make money, if they had rights to children and so on and so forth. And it's very much an uncanny resonance with the contemporary arguments about women's bodies and Roe v. Wade and the turn of the conservative SCOTUS. We started out with this, and it's uncanny how it works, because one of the key arguments is that the babies or the embryos' rights have to be protected. And there's a human rights debate going on with that's linked to fetal personhood. Mm-hmm. So if you conceive of the fetus as a person, then the person has human rights and can't be aborted, can't be subjected to violence, and so on and so forth. And it's uncanny how women's choice, women's bodies, women's self-determination is just talked over.
No, and exactly, but I mean,
preserving.
And these women, of course, this is also, I mean, what these texts, of course, then, you know, comment on, right, is the struggle for women's rights, and which, of course, are also then human rights. There's a lot of debate about, it's not, no coincidence that, you know, marriage is also done away with, right? As men are being done done away with, marriage is done away with. Suddenly, these women are full citizens of their respective countries, obviously, right? With all the rights and all the responsibilities, and they have access to education, and they've access to all jobs. They have to do them also, but they excel at them, right? And this is part. So in both the mental abilities are not questioned, and also the sort of physical abilities and are not questioned. And again, that's interesting because, right, the 19th century is steeped in these ideas of, you know, separate spheres and women being physically weaker, naturally so, and morally superior maybe, but certainly not intellectually. And then what these women, what these authors also sort of argue is, no, that is, of course, partly socially produced, right? Women are kept weak. Women are kept uneducated. And this should change, because only then women can sort of develop their full potential. And they can
and
be full people.
This is, I think,
people.
Where the utopia as a genre also comes in as an ideal genre, because it features, going back to Morris, it features long descriptions of how the state actually works. So, I mean, if you're going to depict an ideal society that works differently, the question is about the institutions, not so much about the individual family as you know, nuclear unit in the society, but how do the institutions work?
Exactly.
What is different? What is organized better? And what I liked specifically about Mizora is the long... You know, sometimes it's a bit dry, but it's very in your face... A description of how an education system could work. Mm-hmm. They're national colleges, they're paid for by the state, the teachers have the highest regard socially and financially, only the best teachers get to teach, and they teach everything. So we don't even have to talk about women, you know, being confined to crocheting and doing needlework or stuff like that. I mean, they teach everything.
Absolutely. And I love
it's
that.
Really egalitarian.
Really, yes. And what I also love, they also teach in these lecture halls that are, they're just like streaming, essentially, right? The best lecturers give lectures, and then the public can go. There's public education, right? People can go and get like a sort of, you know, get a streamed image of the lecturer and get the best like everybody in Mizora, wherever they are, whatever they do, they can have access to the best education, even sort of lifelong learning, right, in this way where and that's also, you know, and made possible through technology, which I, you know, when I first read this was way pre-pandemic, and then pandemic hit, and I would sort of discuss it again with my students in class, and I was like, wait, there's Zooming and there's, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's really absurd. Yeah. But pretty amazing. Again, with all the sort of dark sides of it, again, that it espouses. Like, it's racist. It's violently racist or white supremacist in many ways. But it certainly imagines the world otherwise.
And it does, I mean, it does even out differences in diversity. That's what all utopian fiction in a way does. I mean, everybody has to stick with the system. Everybody has to be a member. Everybody has to participate. There can't be any... you know, straight from that. So that's the, I'm not, you know, in the turn of the century, racism is the ideal solution for that. To say, if we were only had clean food and a clean environment, then our people would be so much better and they would be physically healthier. In Missouri, what the women do, what Vera is so fascinated with, is breathe deeply. I'm like, geez, they're all yogis, you know. Yes. One woman can have 225 square inches of air into you know, stream into her lungs, and they do this as a performance. Say, I breathe so deeply, and then they breathe out again. And you know, I laughed loud when I read it, but it also it makes so much sense with contemporary, you know, understandings of what a good life might be. Mm-hmm. But then again, it has this uncanny racial utopia, white supremacist tinge that doesn't work at all.
Exactly.
So diversity is not okay, and it's not happening.
No.
Everybody,
that only comes much
as
later.
Remember, yeah,
that only becomes much later, where people begin to imagine a better society that includes diversity and difference.
Mm.
Much of these early stories are about getting rid of that difference, getting rid of that. That's the imperfect. And
yeah.
Of course, again,
yeah,
from
whatever the perfect is then. Yeah.
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 But this, again, this is all pre sort of Third Reich and, you know, whatever. But, you know, this is a very prominent idea in these early texts, at least in these two earlier texts.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a good seek also maybe to a short text that we also read. Lily Devereux Blake's Divided Republic. An Allegory of the Future, published in 1885. I mean, the title is already the program, The Divided Republic, An Allegory of the Future. It's a shorter text. It hinges on Lincoln's quote, "House divided against itself cannot stand," from the Civil War. So this is Reconstruction at its best. And it, like 1848, like the first wave of feminism, it uses a key moment in American history and, you know, texts around this moment, namely the American Civil War, to say a portion of the population has been overlooked and it's high time that they're given their due and that we, you know, work towards an egalitarian view. What the 1848ers, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, did was basically write a Declaration of Independence where they inserted, where they replaced the English tyrant king with man who has become a tyrant to woman in the family of man. And they directly take it from there. Now, what Devereux Blake does in A Divided Republic is basically sketch a revolution where the women just leave.
Right.
Because you know, they haven't been given the right to vote. So they just start walking.
Exactly. So it's not. So here it's not a foreign land or, you know, in later texts we get foreign planets or whatever, right? Or a future. It's not that. It's just the West, right? Women from the women of the East, as you say, they're fed up with not being given the vote, not having sort of equal share of sort of having a share in wage earnings and whatever, and so they decide to go west, and they go to the territories, and they establish a women's republic. And again, much like in these other texts, or again, much like in Gilman's text, we have these types, right? Even more so, maybe, right? It's a parable, it's an allegory. We have, you know, the matron, we have the young lover who, with a heavy heart, departs from her sweetheart, but you know, it must be done in order to produce change, right? And so these women, they go west and they establish a women's republic, and again, they're doing pretty well. They're something I always laugh at when I come across it. They wear loose clothes and they do arts and crafts and but then also architecture and science, and again they lecture and they learn and they educate each other, and they build grandiose buildings and everything is wonderful and beautiful, which men eventually get to see, because as the women are leaving, men become, initially are super happy, they're like, it, you know, if they don't want to live under our rule, essentially, right, like they should leave, fine, whatever. And but then of course the East descends into chaos, complete chaos, right? Men are drunk and dirty and they kill each other or whatever, you know, and so everything sort of goes to waste. And they become really desperate and eventually come see the women begging for them to come back. And what they see then, yeah. of course, again, is this contrast. It's this beautiful, perfect society that the women have built in the absence of men.
Yes. Yeah.
And better begging them to
and
return.
I think the turning point comes when they deserted lover petitions to Congress for the women to return, because he can't live without his is it Cecilia? He can't live without his Cecilia.
I think it's so, Rose. It's Rose. There's also Cecilia.
Oh, it's Rose.
Cecilia
okay. well,
is the one Rose, who, yeah. Again, with a heavy heart, she leaves her whole old father behind. So she's the caretaker, right? And it's very much emphasized in the beginning also that, you know, these women, they don't go out of spite or because they're man haters, right? They go because they have no choice. This is the only way. They've tried everything, right?
Yeah, like the Declaration of Independence argument. We've tried everything
now,
in these colonies.
Now we have to go to extreme means. Yeah. And this is just like, we're going to leave and let you figure things out on your... Like, let you figure out that you actually need us. And that you need us in more ways than you maybe sometimes imagine. And yeah. And eventually men come around and give the women voting rights and equal pay and everything they desire in return for return, in return for the women coming back to the East.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And society is, quote, reconstructed.
Yeah. No,
so
absolutely.
It's rebuilt in a better way. It's also a rendition of that American Jeremiah ideal where, you know, we had good beginnings, but then things all went to pieces and now we have to rebuild. And,
absolutely.
It's the women who are really the laborers, the caregivers, and the ones who keep everything together. Which, you know, because the men basically lose it when they have nobody to look after them.
And of course, again, what comes in there is you know, so it's radical in certain ways and it's super conservative in others, because again, there's this idea that of course women are morally superior. Of course men will... They will, again, they will drink, they will kill each other when women aren't present as this sort of balancing or, you know, moralizing presence. But yeah, and then there's also this idea that, yes, there is this utopian women's republic in the West, but the real utopia then happens when they unite. When they unite again, and then everybody's really free. I think that's sort of... I'm paraphrasing, but like, not much. Yeah. This is essentially how the story ends. Everybody's only really truly free when they come together and when everybody has equal rights.
Yeah. And I mean, again, it's an affirmation of the binary model. So so one of the questions that I had for you is how... Is there a queer potential in these texts? For just doing away with the binary model with the power structures that come with this.
Yeah, it depends, I guess, on how you define queer. If you define it narrowly in terms of, like, you know, non-straight, non-heterosexual desires or so forth, no, not much. This is not something that these feminist writers at the time write about, think about. Women are not, you know, when women are left alone, they are left alone to other pursuits than sex. Desire is not on their mind. They're not sexual beings in that way. Queer in the sense of not entirely heteronormative, or in terms of like challenging conceived notions of what a woman is supposed to be like. Yes. So in terms of sort of in terms of gender roles and gender, yes. But again, what as you've said, what remains very clear is that sex binary, that sort of biologistic idea of a sex binary. What is challenged only is, in a way, what women do with themselves, with their bodies, with their minds. Mm. But not there's no questioning in those texts, at least, of heterosexuality as a structuring principle of society, or of this binary sex gender system, really.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. I also think, again, these women are shown in relation. So there's difference, but the difference is in the relationality to the counterpart. Maybe to, on the one hand, the masculine or masculinity, but also to other femininities. And
right, but
there seems to be no imaginary where we can think of humankind as female single sex only.
Yeah. You know? I mean, in certain ways, again, this comes later and later, you know, post-war versions of this narrative where lesbian desire or queer desires come in, and where actually sex comes in. And so necessarily it's homo sexual or queer. Yeah. But in those early texts, that's not the case. But in terms of relationality, I mean, I like what you said earlier. There are different relationalities that are being imagined. You know, it goes beyond the nuclear family. Society, communities are being imagined differently. And that's also one of the reasons why I'm interested in those texts, right? Because there's a political imaginary and there's a social imaginary that is interesting and not necessarily super new or, it's not necessarily something that you haven't heard before, but still, right, it's quite striking in its time in certain ways.
At the end, it's always also about, in these texts, national survival. I mean, empire is written large in this context. We talked about white supremacy, you know, racist tendencies to perfect what American society might look like. This is also under the impression of immigration and immigration regulation laws. So again, these are very white texts the political imaginaries are transgressive limited when it comes to white feminism, but they're absolutely exclusionary or exclusive when it comes to the U.S. as a project, as a utopian project in and of itself.
Absolutely. Violent, even. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, speaking of violence, I don't know whether you also want to talk about that other text by Jack London, because it represents this other kind of, or it represents the flip side in a way, because it imagines an all-male society. Yeah. So, you know, generally speaking, we get many more all-female societies. All-male ones are very, very few. There are some androgynous ones, but there are only very few all-male ones. And Jack London's
maybe because all-male societies in that logic don't serve so well for a utopian place. It can't be beautiful.
No.
It also can't be a no place. No. I don't know.
In that logic, it doesn't work at all. And I mean, in London, it also doesn't work. So, right, it's not, this text is not a utopia. It's sort of, it's a parody of utopia. Initially, the narrator the title is The Strange Experience of a Misogynist. And so the narrator is a misogynist, right? He doesn't like women much. And suddenly, one day, I want to say women, but it's not actually that. It's all females of the earth disappear, which makes that story also super interesting, because it's not only women. It's also all female animals, including bees. And that's explicitly mentioned, which, of course, causes all kinds of problems. Food scarcity. I mean, the end of the world essentially is initiated by the disappearance of all female beings. So it doesn't go well. The all male society doesn't go well.
And what we can maybe quickly say about London's text, published in 1897, so it's also around that time. Of course, it's a parody, but it also is a parody on communist thought, right? Because it's very, it's an economical tract. It uses Marxist language quite a bit and says that now that the women are gone, nobody's working for anything anymore. The superstructure, the government is crumbles really fast and anarchy ensues. Mm-hmm. And what I found so intriguing is the ending, because, I mean, we have this misogynist who's running around first. He's really happy that the women are gone and... But all of a sudden, he realizes that all the men are drinking and there's nothing left. And he comes to a near-death experience where he starts seeing a female vision. And it turns out, and that was such a surprise, it turns out this vision is a woman he knew before that he didn't even know he was in love with. And that struck me as like, okay, where does she come from? So there was no talk about their life before. But then all of a sudden there's Laura. And when I started thinking about this Laura, he wakes up and says he's going to propose to her right away because this is a feverish dream that he's had. So this Laura also represents all the beauty, all the companionship. It's she's taken straight out from Petrarca and from love sonnets. So Petrarca dedicates all his sonnets to Donna Laura. And the Inquist sonnet tradition, the love sonnet tradition, takes up this logic of Laura. So it's not a coincidence that she's called Laura, because the turn is towards love and, you know, being loved, indulging in art, turning towards the beautiful. And that's the antidote to this economic speak that we have throughout. And he happens to be a writer, but he's not writing anymore because his stanzas don't self-reproduce, is what he says. His other friend, the actor, has totally gone off the rails. So even art is stalled when women are gone.
I mean, I think London is poking fun at a lot of things. I mean, he was a socialist, so I mean, I guess he's poking fun, definitely, or he's, you know, showing that sort of the complete absence of women, or like complete absence of government, or, you know, produces problems, obviously. But the ending, I think, is this like cop out. It's also this tradition of, oh, I woke up and it was all a dream, and now I've gone through this experience, or like this, you know, imaginary experience of living in a world without women, and suddenly the bachelor or the misogynist realizes that really he does need a woman in his life, and yeah, so he runs off to Laura. I find that story very interesting in how it manipulates genres and how it parodies them, but also uses them partly seriously and partly satirically. And so it starts as this utopian, or at least in the eyes of the narrator, it's this perfect world now because all the sort of gibbering women are gone. But then again, it descends into this dystopian nightmare.
It's more of a dystopian.
Exactly.
Yeah, post-apocalyptic.
Exactly.
Thing. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. So we've discussed a roster of texts that all, you know, deal with the role of women and maybe the necessity of women to be in the world, and the question of equal rights and representation. Self-representation, artistic production. And we opened with that, you know, timeliness of this moment where women's reproductive rights are at stake here. And I should say that since we both live in Germany, abortion is illegal in Germany, only it doesn't get prosecuted. So we have an interest to look at what happens in the United States when that federal law might be taken away.
And I want to add,
it's not a very happy note to end on. And so maybe you have something cheerful to say.
I don't know whether it's cheerful, but I mean, one of the things that I find striking, and one of the reasons I'm working on this project, is because, you know, I said earlier that there's this early upsurge, right, at the end of the 19th and early 20th century with first wave feminism. There was the second upsurge with a sort of second, third wave feminism in feminist utopias of this kind. And then when I sort of became interested, there was very little around in terms of representations of single sex societies. You know, I looked, you know, is there any recent stuff? And there was very little. But in the past 3-4 years, there has been a lot. I'm just looking, you know, here, because I just ordered a new bunch of texts. And there are these from like 2020, 2021. It's like Manhunt, Afterland, The End of Men, right? There are all these... I mean, I want to say also post-viral, because that's often a narrative that gets picked up in these later texts, right? All the men die from a virus. There are lots of these texts that are now available, or like that are being published right now, that have the same premise. And unfortunately, I have not gotten around to reading them all. But it'll be really interesting to look, you know, again, going back to some of those questions you've asked, how they deal with that problem of the gender binary, how they deal with that problem of sort of supposed binary sex gender system, whether they address it, how would they deal with that, amongst many other things. I mean, aside from all these other topics that we've also addressed, how they deal with science and reproduction and politics and community and so forth. I have this huge
pile. These are the big questions. These are the big questions for our age, plus the ecological crisis, climate change crisis that we're looking at. So there has to be a planetary approach to species survival, or maybe it's just time to be over. And if the apocalypse comes and only the female beings in the world survive, then we have literature to turn to and see how he can organize.
Right. So. I mean, I guess I want to come back to you know, with all the problems that some of these texts have inbuilt, I mean, they are part of this tradition of literature, of imagining things otherwise. And
yeah,
it's not only, you know, people often talk about this rise in dystopian literature in the past years, but there's also a little bit of a return to utopian ideas. And whether it's dystopian or a mix of them, we need these texts that imagine things otherwise, and then we can still sort of disagree with them partly or wholly, or, you know, but we can think about also how we want this world to be and how we want it to continue with men and women and all people of all genders. And so this is also the work that these texts are doing, or that we do when we engage with these texts.
Yes. Thank you. I think that's a great closing statement. Thank you for coming on to this podcast in very busy and mind-boggling times. And thank you for bringing a host of super intriguing literary texts. I certainly look forward to discussing this more with you and to reading a book. Or more publications on this.
So. I hope it's going to be a book one day. So I'll keep you posted.
We'll look out for it.
Thank you very much for having me. Thanks.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the America Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.